the problem with diabetic retinopathy is at the beginning, you actually start without symptoms. And over time, just slowly things start happening that can really start impacting the vision. But the problem is at the later stages of the disease, if you don't control it over time, you don't screen over time, you don't detect it early, then you can have a severe vision loss.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. Our topic today is based on health you can see. Today, we will learn from a seasoned executive with over two decades of experience in AI, life sciences, and healthcare. Joining us from the West Coast is Vicky Demas, CEO of Identify Health. Identify Health is leveraging AI to build a new branch of diagnostic based on retinal imaging that's simple and accessible. Vicky, welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast.
Thank you, Bob. Really excited to be here with you today.
This is going to be a difficult interview for me because I don't really know where to start. And the reason being, I've been a huge fan of what you're doing, and I've immersed myself in understanding the mission you created for Identify Health. And I think, as always, we need to clarify the company name, because when I first saw it, I didn't know how to pronounce it. Then I stopped and I thought about the coolness of what you've done with the name. So the name Identify, I-D-E-N-T-I-F-Y, you've replaced the Y with the last letter Y now becoming the word I. So Identify, E-Y-E, Health. I think that's really cute. Tell me how that happened.
Thank you. We do love our name. We actually went through a branding exercise with the team. So the whole company was involved because we all really just felt very strongly about our mission. We already believe in the power of the eye to be the non-invasive diagnostic platform of our times. And we wanted to have a name that is descriptive, but it's also cute and exciting. We actually had several rounds of reviews with the team and brainstorming, et cetera, before we ended up leveraging this name, which obviously we believe is very appropriate because we look in the eye to identify disease, eventually personalize maps to health and wellness.
Okay, let's start by educating our audience a little bit. Let's start with the eye, the retina, and let's define retinopathy.
For sure. So retina is the back part of the eye. It is where we can directly visualize things like vasculature, arteries, veins, capillaries. It's also part of the central nervous system. So a ton of biomarkers. Retinopathy, now I'm going to go to the, I'm Greek, so it comes from, right, the origin for having a pathology in the retina just means that there is a problem in your eye, in the back of your eye. There are different types of retinopathy, and Identify, obviously, we're starting with diabetic retinopathy, which is specifically associated. It's a complication of diabetes, both type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
So diabetes, probably one of the most unrealized, unrecognized, biggest problems right now. How big is the diabetic issue here in the United States and in the rest of the world as far as that goes?
Unfortunately, Bob, it's a huge problem. I think you said it. I believe the latest numbers, according to the CDC, for the U.S., it's 11.6% of the population. That's more than 38 million people. And globally, we are at about, I believe, half a billion people being diabetics. If you were starting to see, and people obviously are tracking pre-diabetes as well, it's a really huge trend, unfortunately.
Is that tied to lifestyle, obesity, things of that nature, or is it some of it just a natural occurrence of insulin?
There's quite a bit that, again, like this is, I'm not a clinician, but based on my reading, my understanding of the space, a lot of it has to do with nutrition and how we have evolved as humans, access to foods that are really high concentration in carbs and fats and et cetera. The fact that there is lack of awareness, time, resources, there's definitely a correlation with based on socioeconomic status as well. So that ties into the education, to the access, to the means to have good, healthy, nutritional food.
Okay. So when we talk about diabetic retinopathy, what are the consequences? Does this thing happen quickly? Is it something that builds over a period of time? But what is the effect of diabetic retinopathy?
So diabetic retinopathy is something that develops over time. It's not an acute, it's more of a chronic problem, which is also why if you look at the screening guidelines, it gets screened once a year. The problem is that people don't actually take care of everything they need to take care of. And it's hard to think that you'll go to the doctor in the first place when you're not in pain or you don't have any symptoms. And that's exactly the problem with diabetic retinopathy is at the beginning, you actually start without symptoms. And over time, just slowly things start happening where you can imagine things are leaking from the vasculature. There can be small hemorrhages. There are all kinds of different things that can really start impacting the vision. But the problem is at the later stages of the disease, if you don't control it over time, you don't screen over time, you don't detect it early, then actually you can have a severe vision loss. It is actually the leading cause of blindness in ages between 22 and 74, so the working age, if you wish.
Wow. So this is a serious concern, of course. Detection's got to be the key element of prevention, because once you've been impacted by this, there's not a recovery plan. There's nothing you can do. You can't take more vitamin A or change your diet and get your eyesight back. That damage has been done then, right?
Correct. So what's really exciting with what we're trying to do as well and why this is so important, 95% of vision loss from diabetic retinopathy complications are preventable if detected early. And that's why I'm so excited and motivated is imagine if you can actually tell the patient that, listen, we see some early signs, you're going to lose your eyesight potentially, start modifying what you eat, keeping control of your A1C, keeping your diabetes under control practically. We really think that the impact can be really big in changing the outcomes.
I recently went to my ophthalmologist for my checkup. It was a new doctor I'd not been to before, and he spent an hour and a half doing a thorough check, and he went on to elaborate on how important it is to use the eye as a portal to the rest of the body. He said, there's no other way that you can look into the body without being invasive than other than looking through the eye. And he said, I can tell whether you've got diabetes or prediabetes. I can tell if you have hypertension. He said, I can tell so many things. And most of the primary care doctors aren't aware of this. They don't have time to look at this. But I walked away from that interview with him with the details, and I thought, this is incredible. This is really the technology and be able to detect this. And I asked him, I said, how many people do this? And he said, not enough. And not enough people are knowledgeable about it. They don't understand it. So that kind of brings up the whole mission that you're on here with Identify. Your background, let's talk about that a little bit, because I think it's really important. I want to get into how you started up with Identify, and I want to touch a little bit on Jonathan Rothberg and Four Catalyzer, a little bit of insights on that. But you're with a cancer detection company, Grail. What were you doing there? They went public not long ago, right?
Correct. Grail went public not too long ago. Before that, it had been acquired by Illumina, which originally we came from. So we were going to go public maybe 4 years ago. Then Illumina acquired the company, and then they divested it. But so I joined Grail in the early days. I had worked very closely with Jeff Huber, who was the founding CEO of Grail. And he founded Grail for personal reasons, unfortunately, a tragic death in his family. So I joined Jeff and the team, and I knew quite a bit of the team. Vic Bajaj was the founding chief scientific officer, who I had worked with also before. So I joined the team to really help figure out, Jeff would call it like the building the tests of the future, really just at the end of the day, build a test that makes cancer more like a chronic disease, something that we can really treat and manage and control. And it's all about early disease detection. So the first thing I did was work with a very small group of people within the company to work what at the time we had called it was a below the line assay. So the majority of the team was working on a different technology, more traditional in the sequencing world, whole genome sequencing, targeted assays. And Jeff Vick really believed in the potential of methylation as an area of potential, I'll just say, very rich information. So that's more like environmental impact and other things, right, and so forth. We worked with a very small team to really build the platform, the technology that ended up now enabling the first product, which is Galleri, which is a screening test for cancer. It's a 50 cancer indication screening test. Of course, there were a series of other things and a lot of excitement, but I definitely do hope that that what we did at Grail will change how we think of cancer in the future.
Wow, that's such a compelling story. I'm so glad to have you share that. Now, before Grail, you were one of the founding members of the life science team at Google. Now, that's got to be exciting. Tell me a little bit more about your role there.
Sure. That was a really fun time for sure. It all started too with in a very mystical way. I got contacted by recruiters out of the blue when Google, and it was through Google X, was looking to start the life sciences initiatives. And the goal was to leverage AI and the tools that make Google to actually solve problems worth solving. And in our particular case, in life sciences and healthcare. They wouldn't tell me, of course, it was all very secretive. But nonetheless, once I got there and I realized this is what I was going to be doing, I had a blast. We ended up building a series of teams working with industry leaders to try to define some of these problems, the spaces. Some of it actually included a project very dear now to my heart and what we're doing, which was a collaboration between Google, Verily, Nikon, Opto, specifically to apply AI for retinal imaging applications. So it is, we started the space, we started a lot of really exciting programs and projects in diagnostics and interventional surgical robotics, nanoparticle delivery platforms, et cetera, et cetera. But when you want the time, it was a unique opportunity. I got to work with some of the most incredible people. Yeah, spun out several programs into joint ventures. I don't know. Yeah,
it's a destiny.
It was incredible. It was, yeah.
It's a destiny. It had to happen. I've been following a lot of that. In 2018, the annual developer conference, Sundar Pichai, the CEO, 8 minutes into that annual developer conference, he pulls up and he starts to talk about a project they've been working on at Google dealing with ROP, retinopathy of premature. And they had a seven-person team there that was going out into India, gathering all of these images and starting this whole process of using machine learning to try to figure out how to do screening for this particular type of retinopathy. That's for premature babies, I assume. Were you involved? Was that after you or before you, that project, as that kicked off? Because they spent a lot of time. They had a seven-person team there working on that for quite a bit. And a lot of ophthalmologists trying to label these scans and images and really trying to make something come forth from there.
So it all started, I think, at the same set of, I'll say, collaborations and principles and the work that came in the space. I think it's a team of Phil Nelson and others. That work, 2018, I actually left Google in 2016.
Okay.
But a lot of the programs, again, we started, continued over time, they still exist. And Google has built some incredible tools that, of course, Google, in the very democratizing access way that they have, they actually have been very open and sharing with others.
So Verily, I heard in the news recently that they are moving to Dallas, Texas.
Yes, I think that's related also. Again, like I'm not qualified to speak to it, but from where I stand, I think it's more their new CEO. So the transition happened from Andy Conrad to Steve a few years back. So I think that's where he's based.
Yes. I had the opportunity to interview on a previous podcast, Dr. Vivian Lee. She had a book out called The Long Fix. So I was always curious to see how the life sciences and AI and all these technologies start to merge together. Let's shift into Identify. How did that start? How did you get lined up with that? You've been there several years now. You're the CEO, and you are part of the Four Catalyzer. And most people may not know about Jonathan Rothberg and Four Catalyzer, but there's a whole suite of companies, including yours, that are under that umbrella. Can you speak a little bit about that and educate us along that line?
Yeah, there are a few questions here, background. Jonathan Rothberg is an incredible entrepreneur, technology entrepreneur. He's won awards. He started actually more in the sequencing space, but he's the founder of many companies. We'll start with, so Four Catalyzer is actually an incubator. So that is Jonathan's incubator, and several companies have spun out of Four Catalyzer. So and that's a little bit, these are all independent entities at this point, including Identify Health. But some of the more well-established companies people might know about would be, for example, Butterfly Networks and Hyperfine. So he has a portable ultrasound, a portable MRI company. So quite a bit. Jonathan likes to say he likes building companies that help people he loves, people he cares about. So he has personal stories for them. Yeah, I'm trying to think back in now a little bit over 3 years ago. Of course, I knew who Jonathan Rothberg was, and I knew Four Catalyzer. You cannot be in the space and not know who he is. So Jonathan sent me a note. It was, I believe it was April or maybe a little bit earlier, April 2021. And I got a note from Jonathan, a little cryptic, saying, hey, I got your name from people I know and I have worked with and I respect, and I thought we should connect. And we connected. And he spoke to me a little bit about what the company at the time was called. It was a Tesseract. And it was more of that he had a very different vision. I think it was a Tesseract being the fourth dimensional cube. You're using multiple imaging modalities to capture all these different types of data. And he wanted me to join, to come and lead the company. So for me at the time, it was okay, I wasn't looking for a job. I'm happy. I love my team, where I am. but here's a problem that I have felt very strongly about in terms of the platform that we had, or at the time I was thinking the ability to build is just incredible. And it was almost like the perfect place. Like I had all of these experiences and lessons learned from previous companies that I thought would really put me in a position to really bring this to the finish line, to really launch a product that can make an impact. Between the earlier views, the understanding that what it would take is not really just, it's not just about adding more data. It's making sure that you address the concept of how do we capture good quality data. Obviously, as I add more platforms, modalities, I can add richer, I can capture better, richer data sets. But at the end of the day, we need to start with the basic principle, which is how do I bring technologies close to the patients and make them scalable and accessible? And then also, how do we interpret them so that the whole workflow is addressed on the spot next to the patient while you have them there and you can actually start working on the next steps? So that's a little bit the coming, jumping in, because I had a vision that I was super excited. The lessons learned, I didn't mention at Grail, as exciting as what we built is, it will take time, for example, to get reimbursement for a multi-cancer screening test. You have to build utility. It will take a long time for everyone who needs the test to be able to afford it. So for Identify, there was the problem, the well-known founder, known actually established credible investors, and my opportunity to come in and help build the team, really refocus on something that I think, again, like learning from the past of what will it take to build a product that can really start helping patients right away while we can also help capture the potential of the platform farther down the line.
Your perspective on this was to come up with a workable solution that's real, that's actionable. It's just not deep science research, but something that's practical that can be used. When you look at diabetic retinopathy,
and you say, this is a huge problem. We know it needs to be addressed. What does it require to do that? You have to capture images, and you have to be able to screen those images, and you have to be able to take the results and take action on those for those who need it. Not everybody's going to need action, but those who do, you want to make sure that's done in a timely fashion. So you set out to do what? Are you creating a product now, I believe, that includes those elements? It has a way to capture images. It has a way to basically deploy these into a primary care environment. Is that part of the vision?
Absolutely, yes. So you captured exactly all the elements of what I think it takes for solving diabetic retinopathy screening or making it accessible, cost-efficient, et cetera. It's the being able to capture the images, good quality images that can then be analyzed and do it at the primary care setting, because it is already hard for people to go see their doctor to begin with. But we know that 80 to 90% of people living with diabetes will actually go to primary care versus the numbers looking much lower for also going to an ophthalmologist. So we're leveraging AI and automation to make capturing of the images, the data, simple enough that then eventually this platform can become a lot more, I'll call them eventually ubiquitous, but at least be on the primary care setting. Think that we're looking for example, for the very busy medical assistant being able to operate this device when they're setting up a patient to be seen by a doctor. So that's the right intuitive, easy to use, capture the image, make sure then we use AI to analyze the images, and that's going to be the first, we'll call it AI-based pure diagnostic screening product to say, okay, is everything looking okay? Should we see you in a year? Versus we see something worrisome that we can't analyze, or we see more than mild diabetic retinopathy, which automatically means that you should be seen by an ophthalmologist and start getting monitored. Also starting to have, as we said, the conversations with your doctor about controlling your A1C and making sure that you do everything that you can to prevent the disease from further progression.
So I could see a new future where I go back to my primary care doctor, and while they're taking my blood and measuring me, my weight and my height, and looking at my blood pressure, basic data acquisition, they may say, sit down here and look into this, and it just take a couple minutes. We're just going to check your eyes. And the results immediately pop up that says, your eyes are great. Not your vision, but the health of your eye is good. Or, no, I think that we have a concern here, and we're going to recommend you to someone else to look at this issue. They've done a screening for me, and that primary doctor, primary care doctor, he didn't really have to do anything, did he? He just had to see the results and make the recommendation, the referral?
I'd love to actually find out more about exactly what they use, and there are a lot of really exciting tools. Clinicians can tell a lot by looking at the eyes. It's not as simple. It's more, it takes training, but they can see inflammation. They can see, I know people who have been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis after an ophthalmology screening. But at the end of the day, maybe I'll speak a little bit about our vision is that eventually, exactly, you can actually not even go to your doctor. Eventually, you can imagine that we're building systems that are so easy to operate that the exam can be self-administered. I'll decouple a little bit the longer-term vision of where I think the platform should go and will go. But then we'll speak a little bit about the very tractable, tactical path that we're taking to start getting our products cleared by the FDA so that they can be placed, they can be acknowledged, they can be reimbursed, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So that's a huge hurdle there, isn't it? Getting that in place.
Yes, it is.
We'll come back to that in a second. On the AI side of things, back in 2016, 17, 18, when Google was starting to look at ROP, retinopathy of premature, they had dozens of doctors, ophthalmologists looking at scans and trying to label this data so that they could start to do some machine language modeling on it, build some type of model on that. That was 2018. Here we are in 2024. And it seems to me, in my limited knowledge, I took a 7-week course at MIT on AI. So I'm in the shallow end of the pool, and I'm trying to get into the deeper end more so every day. But I stop and think now today where you've got back propagation neural networks and things of that nature, does that make it easier to start to build these AI models to do basically the screening process for retinopathy?
So I think I'm going to disappoint you if I say that the methods that we use today to develop algorithms for this nature, right? And we're speaking about building classifiers, disease classifiers for diabetic yeah. retinopathy screening. Where we are using the same, I'll call them basic models, and we still require one of the biggest limitations in all of this is having the right data with the right annotations. And the limitation, which is something that Google had published years back, I believe this one was in 2017, the limitation on the performance on the algorithm is related to the number of humans you can use as human graders on an image. The way that we've done the development of our algorithms, we've leveraged hundreds of thousands, let's say leveraged, we licensed hundreds of thousands of images that were clearly labeled and annotated. We just ran a study where the way that we even conduct the studies, the way that the FDA expects us to conduct the studies, we have three human graders. And when they disagree, we put them in a room, there is adjudication, and we come up with a consensus on what should be the baseline we compare against. So there are a lot of methods and tools that will continue to be developed, but there is also lag between when are we going to get to the place where you don't need to spend the time and energy and money to do the annotation. And we're not there yet. And we did say we're going to come back to the FDA and regulatory hurdles. But there's also, even from a technical perspective, just seeing some of the exciting tools that are coming up. And there have been a lot of noise and excitement in the last 2 years since OpenAI. They're not where some of the, I'll call them basic. We're doing image processing at the end of the day. Neural networks have been around for a while, and they're quite incredible.
Came a long way from AlexNet, all the vision stuff of years ago. Getting back to the FDA, and if you have images coming in from different sources, if you make a camera, do they want you to have all of your images coming from that camera in order to get FDA approval? How stringent are they? This is a new area for FDA, and I'm trying to educate our audience here a little bit about it as well. What's this 510K and what's involved, and what are their requirements for things like this that are complicated?
For sure. So there are a couple of things. So the first question you ask, it is for sure very specific that the FDA will tell you, you can do development in whatever you want, but what you're going to include as your submission, the pivotal study, the data that shows them that you've built something that stands up to the claims you want to make, is actually really paired. So you have algorithm that will work with images that have come with this very specific device. And the data you submit to them is based on that, and all of the powering of the study, et cetera, is all coming from that camera. And there are predicates in the space, and well, now I'm going to speak a little bit, what does it mean to get a 510K versus a de novo? 510K by definition means that there is a predicate. There is someone that is doing this similarly to what you're doing. That doesn't mean that you're not bringing innovation, but in our space in particular, There have been algorithms that have been cleared by the FDA to specifically screen for diabetic retinopathy or more than mild diabetic retinopathy with different camera systems. But think of them as like they have developed a piece of software, Microsoft Office, to work on someone else's system versus us coming in and saying, no, you can't really decouple because you do need the AI to guide, make sure you get a good set of data. If you need to retake it, you retake it. You really just aid on the capturing, et cetera. But back to the 510K point is, you're going to the FDA and you're saying, I'm doing something as well or better than someone else. Yeah. And you actually, and the way people compare is you actually have to have enough data to show your sensitivity and specificity. And that is relative to what you've done with your algorithm, and in our case, with your camera and your algorithm, versus what would this patient have been, or participant for the study, would have been screened, would that have been a positive or negative result when we use the standard of care with dilation and three readers, three humans, judging whether that participant had the disease or not and what stages of the disease. So that's a little bit what the 510K, and there are other components too. Obviously, like the FDA assesses the how different, right? Like what is it that we're trying to accomplish? Are we changing a workflow? Are we could, right? Or what is the potential risk? So there are other components there as well.
It sounds almost like an Apple computer, an Apple model, where it's all integrated together and there's the whole system talks to it. It's all coordinated. It's all lined up. And it removes a lot of the variability and things that could go wrong. That's pretty interesting, that process. Is that a long process? Or is there a big traffic jam right now with people trying to get the FDA to look at their AI stuff in general, not just in your field, but in the overall field of AI? Is it efficient, quick, or long haul?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
Yeah,
I think even with or without AI, to me, and when you build medical devices, you have to work with the FDA, and I'm grateful for the fact that FDA exists, making sure that we build safe devices and such, and we can help patients. But my sense is they're understaffed, and they're always a huge backlog of things, and they try their best. They'll say, if you submit a 510K, you're going to hear back from us within 90 days. The average process takes 6 months of back and forth. And this is the simpler version of anything you could potentially build working with the FDA. So I know they're doing their best, and there is a lot of excitement in the AI space or leveraging AI as a tool. I don't know whether there is any difference, if you wish, in a sense, because at least like the way that we are submitting or we intend to submit our 510K for Identify DR, that's how we're going to call this, it looks like a piece of software, right? So in that sense, it's not different. But what is different is, obviously, they have less experience with these things. There's less guidance going into it than if you were actually building standard software. They have a lot more support that they can provide to product developers for more traditional products. Versus here, there is a little bit more back and forth to make sure that there is the educational piece. They're trying to figure out exactly what they want and so forth. But yeah.
So is the rest of the world a more attractive place to get these products initiated? Or does everybody want to start here in the USA and then move to the rest of the world?
So I think the regulations in EU have changed quite a bit as well. So there is a stringent regulatory process now there as well. So things, the landscape is changing. There are a lot of reasons to want to try to, from my perspective, there are multiple things. It's not just regulatory hurdles, how you decide where, but it's more understanding reimbursement, understanding who is going to be able to use the system. How progressive are the healthcare providers, et cetera, to actually do. So there are a lot of reasons to contemplate all different places. For us, it's more starting in the US makes a ton of sense. There are a lot of places and people we could actually help with this. And coming from the US, it is a little bit easier because getting a clearance here will put you up like a little bit higher up in terms of confidence level, et cetera.
Yeah, the frustrating thing, in my opinion, is that in China, India, rest of the world, there are millions of people that will benefit from what you're doing, Vicky. It's such a difference maker in their lives. Keep people from going blind. I mean, how much more importance can you put on something like that? So get the regulatory things out of the way. Let's get the business of helping these patients a little bit. So, to wrap things up, tell me a little bit, we're trying to benefit our audience. Does it take a huge team? I know you've got a great team. Does it take a large team to do the work that you're doing? And I know you're focused here on diabetic retinopathy, but I think your larger vision is to look at the eye for a whole variety of other things. That's just like the warm-up with diabetic retinopathy. Does it take a large team right now to do the development and to do the tinkering and all of the AI technology necessary to get results? Or can you do that with a pretty lean team?
I think maybe I'll define size of the team just to be on the same page, because I've worked in tiny startups and I've worked in really large startups. Okay. We are about 45 people, and it is a lean team when you're thinking about how many different things we're doing, right? We have a complex device, hardware, software, and when I say software, we are cloud connected, right? Everything is running through an app on an iPad mini. We're controlling the camera, we're capturing the photos, we're analyzing. So we have data science, software, embedded software, hardware, we have clinical operations, right? We need to run studies to make sure that we get the right data, that we test, we improve our devices. Of course, everything you'd imagine operationally to make sure that we can function as an organization. We have now commercial. So I think we're a very lean team. And I think part of it is because we're focused, right? Like you can imagine that everything we do is, as long as you time it, you can start leveraging then. Like we built a product that we are, and then that product can help us capture data and images. We are building an algorithm based on these images, right? Or we're refining it because we leveraged other data. Then we're going to launch that product. We're going to collect more data that will help drive the development of a lot of the future products. So, and our team transitions through. So as long as you have your basic, your engineering, your quality, your regulatory, your operations, we can address problems pretty methodically.
So you're sitting on G looking for O. Go. Well, so what's holding you back? Is it just the FDA blessing this thing? Is that the only thing that holds you back here?
There are a few things. FDA blessing it does help you go through specific processes and make sure you have thought through everything you need to think through, right? You need to make sure becoming a commercial entity, this will be a big deal for us as an organization. So we need to make sure we have the right processes in place. And we feel really good that, right, we can manufacture our devices at the right sizes, the right numbers, et cetera. We can distribute them. So there are some operational hurdles and, right, that we really need to just make sure that we are where we need to be. And then, yes, of course, we do need to wrap up and feel good about where we are with performance, have the submission and get the regulatory clearances that we need to make sure that everybody feels really good about the product that we're pushing out there.
I tell you, it's very refreshing to see the innovation that is taking place here. This is a new frontier. There's a really great book that I have enjoyed, and hopefully our audience is listening to it as well. It's called The Coming Wave. It's by Mustafa Suleiman. He is the head of Microsoft's AI initiative. And the book is really great. It talks about all the advancements that have taken place in the last few years. And it also provides a pretty interesting warning for what we should be concerned with in the future as well. And I see that's what's going to be happening with you and your organization, is that when this is revealed and people see that we have a magnificent superhuman tool that can help millions of people that you'll never meet, wow, that is a phenomenal accomplishment. So I'm honored to be able to have a conversation with you. Vicki, this has been a great discussion. I think Identify Health is the real deal, and it's going to help a whole lot of people. So thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.